Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The leader of Hamas says recent operations by Palestinians inside the occupied territories revealed that Israel is weaker than called a spider's web. Sudanese security forces fire tear gas at people protesting against military rule. Also ahead, a bomb blast in Kabul leaves one person dead a day after an explosion killed some 50 worshippers in a mosque in the Afghan capital. Hello and welcome to your world news. Thank you for joining us. The leader of Hamas and the besieged Gaza Strip warns Israel about the consequences of desecrating Palestinian sanctities, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Take a listen.
This means one thing, that the enemy wants to turn this war and this battle into a religious battle. We prefer that the battle not turn into a religious battle. But if the heads of the occupation and its extremists want to turn it into a religious battle, we're all for it, and we accept the challenge.
Yahya Sinwar noted that defending Palestinian holy sites, particularly the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is the responsibility of resistance groups and the Palestinian nation. The Hamas leader also said Palestinians' recent operations inside the occupied territories reveal that Israel is weaker than, quote, a spider's web. He made the remarks during a speech commemorating International Quds Day. The Hamas official also slammed as traitors Arab states that seek to normalize ties with Israel. Israeli forces have arrested the suspected killers of a settlement guard shot in an attack in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military says the suspects were arrested in a village after a day-long manhunt. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed wing of the Fatah faction, claimed responsibility for the shooting. The group said the attack was a response to violations committed by the regime in Al-Quds. The regime's forces also killed a Palestinian in an operation they claim was linked to the hunt for the attackers. That's after dozens of people heard in Israeli attacks at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The unrest came on the last Friday of the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan and brought to nearly 300 the number of Palestinians injured over a two-week period in clashes at the site. Political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas says the Israeli regime is losing its grip in the occupied territories amid the recent increase in Palestinian operations there. Let's take a listen.
Well, increasingly, you're seeing the Israeli forces acting in a kind of very, very reactionary manner. You're seeing them get more and more anxious, more and more fearful. And a lot of their strategies they give off the air of desperation. This incident sounds like just one of those realities, because they're losing grip. Not only are they losing grip in terms of their military dominance and the narrative that they had about invincibility with the Iron Dome, their much vaunted Israeli high-tech army. Of course, all of these myths have gradually and steadily been eroded through the victories of the Islamic resistance. They've done it steadily in Israel, they've done it across the borders in Lebanon, Hezbollah's been responsible there, and more latterly we've seen the Palestinian resistance grow a real backbone, and it's the military armed resistance combined with on-the-ground uprising.
The Sudanese capital, Khartoum, is once again the scene of protests against military rule in the country. The crowds blocked a major road junction in the capital for a sit-in where they brought food to break their Ramadan fast. The security forces, however, reportedly attempted to break up the rally by firing tear gas and chasing them into side streets. The protesters were marking the third anniversary of the killings of scores of demonstrators in the city. Months-long unrest in Sudan led to the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. A power-sharing deal struck between the military and civilians was scrapped in a coup in October last year. Many officials who worked in the former Bashir regime have been allowed to return to civil service or have been released from jail, intensifying people's anger. A new bomb attack has hit the Afghan capital Kabul, killing one woman. A spokesman for Kabul's commander says three others were also wounded after a passenger van exploded in the city. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the bombing, but a Daesh terrorist group has claimed similar attacks in the past. The incident comes a day after an explosion killed some 50 worshippers after Friday prayer in a Kabul mosque. the country has increasingly been hit by terrorist attacks. This has raised security fears on the eve of Eid al-Fitr on Sunday, a religious occasion marking the end of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan.
Afghanistan, once again facing waves of deadly attacks. In the latest incident, a powerful explosion hit Khalifa Sahib Mosque in the capital, Kabul, killing and injuring dozens of worshippers.
Every Friday, people come to the mosque to say their prayers. Hearing the bomb explosion, I entered the mosque. I am shocked as I'm talking. We took more than 200 casualties to the hospital. It was so horrifying that I had never witnessed such a scene.
Previously, we were falling victim to the US and Taliban war. However, the situation has now changed, but we are still being killed in the mosques and schools. We don't know who are carrying out such blind attacks, but I'm sure the attackers are not Muslims.
Exhausted by growing violence, people of Afghanistan are calling for an end to terror attacks and punishment for the perpetrators. In the recent days, several large bomb attacks targeted public places in the capital, Kabul, Mazar-i Sharif, and Kunduz provinces. The attacks have taken a scores of lives, mostly from the Hazara community. Bomb attacks in Afghanistan continue as Afghans are observing the holy month of Ramadan. People here believe their enemies are missing new chance to harm innocent Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The French president says his country will step up its military and humanitarian support for Ukraine as Russia escalates its warnings and criticism. Emmanuel Macron made the announcement on a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky. Since Russia launched a war against Ukraine, NATO members and allies have provided billions of dollars in military support to Kiev. The supplied weapon systems range from surface-to-air missiles to heavy artillery and surveillance equipment. The U.S. alone has provided $3 billion in aid. And a vast increase to such aid. The U.S. president also called on Congress to provide $33 billion in mostly military assistance for Ukraine. Moscow says the aid fuels the conflict and also risks direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers. It has warned any attempt to interfere in the war will be met with a swift response from Moscow. Islamophobia is on the rise around the world, but the most violent attacks on Muslims are being carried out in the West, such as in the U.S. In the meantime, calls are growing for addressing the long-running discrimination and hatred against the faith group.
A recent report by the Council on American Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, described Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government's institutions and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on.
According to the Council on the American Islamic Relations, over $100 million was funneled into 26 Islamophobia network groups between 2017 and 2019. An earlier study had put the figure at some $1.5 billion. That makes Islamophobia a considerably lucrative industry. Who is behind such activities, and what's their endgame?
The Council on the American-Islamic Relations describes what it calls the Islamophobia Network as a decentralized group of actors, organizations, and individuals that share extreme anti-Muslim ideologies who lobby to influence government policy and public opinion about Islam. They include politicians, think tanks, scholars, religious groups, and activists that paint a distorted face of Islam and Muslims for political and financial gain. Listed among the top financiers of the Islamophobia Network, according to the council, are right-wing evangelical groups and pro-Israel organizations, most of whom are members of the Republican Party. Back in December, the U.S. House voted for legislation to counter Islamophobia globally. The lawmakers voted along party lines, with the Democrats edging only 7 votes over the 212 that the Republicans had cast. It followed U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert's Islamophobic comments against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the handful Muslim lawmakers in the U.S., earlier that month. The United Nations has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
Veteran Iranian movie producer, director, and researcher Nader Tolebzadeh has passed away at the age of 69. His career featured a range of thought-provoking productions and outstanding activities. The following report briefly introduces some of those activities by the renowned movie director.
Nader Tolebzadeh is a familiar name not only to most Iranians, but to many overseas. He was known for his unique documentaries and programs, producing numerous award-winning movies. As an independent filmmaker, Tolebzadeh directed several documentaries about the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. His documentaries featured the resistance of Iranian forces as well as the ravages of war, which were a legacy of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's aggression against Iran. Tolebzadeh also made a documentary about alleged Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, banned weapons that the U.S. claimed Saddam's regime possessed and based on that claim invaded the Arab country in 2003. In 2007, Tolebzadeh produced his first feature-length movie titled The Messiah. It depicts the life and teachings of Jesus from an Islamic perspective and based on the Holy Quran. His research for the movie spanned an entire decade. Also a TV presenter, Tolebzadeh wrote and hosted a talk show dubbed The Secret for Press TV. Furthermore, he was the chairman of the International New Horizon Conference. That's an annual event serving as a platform for denouncing U.S. and Israeli policies. Tolebzadeh was blacklisted and sanctioned by Washington for organizing the conference.
I loved Nader very deeply. He was like an uncle to me. I cherished his memory, and I was so honored to have been invited to the New Horizons Conference.
One of the great ironies of being in Iran and meeting all these fantastic people invited to Iran by Nader Tolebzadeh, that we were experiencing, you know, free speech. I hadn't really appreciated how censored and how narrow our discussions were in North America among fellow academics, how censored we were until I got to Iran. And the fact that we were engaging in free speech and free commentary on some of the most forbidden subjects in the world.
During his career, Tolebzadeh also organized several film festivals, taught at an Islamic movie-making institute, and served as the manager of a Center for Cinematic Research and Studies. Recently, he suffered from ill health. Tolebzadeh had been in hospital for some time before he succumbed to complications of heart disease on the 29th of April, 2022.
Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted an exhibition of Islamic costumes. The event has brought together clothing designers from different Muslim countries to showcase their traditional clothes. Yusuf Jalali has this report.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume and women dress like me or the clothes that you see behind me. They are our traditional clothes.
The shirt this man is wearing is made from a Syrian cloth called the maska. It's a famous Syrian cloth that's made out of silk and cotton. Syrian men wear them in celebrations such as weddings and also during our festivities such as Eid al-Fitr.
Aside from showcasing their costumes, the participating nations also get to introduce their Ramadan traditions and what they have for iftar breakfast.
In Syria, it's customary to break a Ramadan fast with our traditional appetizers such as fattoush and tabbouleh. In my city, Aleppo, we start with dairy such as hot milk. Afterwards, we eat the main dish, which varies from a city to the other.
In Afghanistan, we cook our delicious gulani and ashak for Ramadan breakfast. These foods actually are cooked for our dearest guests in other months of the year.
Organized jointly by Iran's Echo Office and the Culture Ministry, the event seeks to bring about a stronger bond between Muslim nations by sharing their cultures and traditions.
Here, Muslims get together to find their commonalities and at the same time learn about their differences. The expo also brought exhibitors coming from ECO member states. The reason we held it in the holy month of Ramadan is to say that despite all our differences, all of us are Muslims and need to unite.
Muslims say Ramadan brings them together more than any other time, since they all practice the same religious tasks throughout the month. And as the call to prayers resonated in the exhibition, all fasting Muslims left the expo for a shared iftar breakfast.
Despite all the differences in languages, costumes, and even Ramadan meals, people here say they feel like they're one nation, since they all come from Muslim countries. And organizers say this is what Ramadan offers, a taste of peace and friendship that transcends all differences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. These hours, the faithful are sad that the blessed month of Ramadan is bidding farewell. They hope to have been able to draw God's satisfaction in this month. True happiness is absent in the modern world. Today, the Western civilization has provided a variety of games and means of entertainment for human beings. Yet, the statistics reveal a bitter reality. The number of depression, absurdity, and aimlessness is increasing on a daily basis. The Western civilization is very boisterous and fussy, but inwardly it is cold, desperate, indolent, and hollow. According to the Quran, what brings calm to the heart and spirit is remembrance of God. Remembrance of God is embodied in the form of serving fellow men and making them happy. Our leaders say that giving charity is a way to make others happy. Charity causes many blessings in life. There are two kinds of charity in Islam. One is obligatory, like zakat, which should be paid in special conditions. Another kind of charity is non-obligatory and recommended. Zakat should be paid in a specified amount to the sources, which religion determines. But non-obligatory charity has no time or amount, and we are free to pay to anyone we like. God's last messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said to Imam Ali, peace upon him, to try to pay charity as much as he could, even if it may seem extravagant in the eyes of the people. God says, I have assigned an agent for taking everything except charity, which I take it myself from my servant. The Prophet says, just as you bring up a young horse or a young camel, God brings up the date or loaf of bread which you have given as charity so that it grows as big as Uhud Mountain. On the day of resurrection, when the earth is entirely in fire, charities will make shadow over the faithful and immune them against the hardships of the day. The Prophet has advised us to give charity every day. According to the Islamic narrations, charity is not limited to spending money. Rather, it includes helping people and removing their problems. However, the best charities are the ones which are given and done in Ramadan or on Friday. Giving up sahari or pre-dawn meal is quite false, as it will cause weakness for fasting persons. Giving up sahari will undermine muscles. Sahari should contain the things which prevent thirst. Thus, salads and watermelon are suitable. Foods like macaroni and ashreshte are not good, as they cause thirst. Ashreshte is an Iranian porridge, which is made up of vegetables, grains, and special noodles. It is very tasty, but is not recommended to have before dawn. We'd better to avoid foods containing aubergine, sausage, salami, mayonnaise, garlic, onion, and fatty and salty meals. Bread and low-salt cheese with vegetables can be a good choice. Liquid stews are also good for this time. Juicy fruits are also very good, as they provide water during the day. As it has been said before, gluttony will overload the digestive system and will cause dyspepsia, stomachache, and flutinous. In other words, in order to avoid reflux of stomach, it is better to drink water and other juices at the end of the food. After finishing sahari or pre-dawn meal, we'd better wait for a few minutes and then go to bed. Generally, fried foods are not that useful during Ramadan. These foods require a lot of dressing and curries and cause thirst and sour stomach. Once you eat these foods, you'd better add lemon, yogurt, and vegetables. The sweets and pastries like zulbia, bamiye, should not be eaten too much, as they contain high amount of sugar and can cause problems for stomach. The travelers in the way of Allah consider the blessed month of Ramadan as the beginning of the year. They assign serious programs for self-purification, which they seriously try to comply with them. They try to gain the best benefits from the hours and moments of this month to deserve gaining the divine mercy. Following the practice of pious ulama will help us in self-purification and reaching God's proximity. Mirza Muhammad Jafar Ansari was a great clergyman and a relative of the highly renowned jurisprudent of all times, Sheikh Murtaza Ansari. Mirza Muhammad had learned the Quran by heart. It has been written on him that he not only would perform his obligatory daily prayers, he would also perform recommended non-obligatory prayers. He used to recite one part of the Quran every day. He would perform the long Ja'far Tayyar prayer and Ziyarat Jame'e and Ziyarat Ashura every day. The former is a long standard form of salutation of the infallible imams, which helps us know them better. Ziyarat Ashura is also a standard form of salutation of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, which has been emphasized by many ulama to be read as many times as one can. Mirza Muhammad was very sharp-minded, and he knew many prayers and supplications by heart. We hope that God will help us follow great religious figures as our own role models. Amen.
Food for thought. Hello everyone, and may God accept your fasting in the blessed month of Ramadan. We now present you a short but sweet supplication to God Almighty at the time of breaking the fast by Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. O Allah, we have fasted for you, and open it with the food provided by you. Accept it from us. Indeed, you are the all-hearing and the all-knowing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, you will discuss issues, relevant questions, and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children. And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet, and of course, of the Prophet himself, and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Sheikh, in extension of our previous session's topic of how teenagers, they are very aggressive and provocative and sensitive when reacting to different things, stimuli, and so on and so forth. And we also see that teenagers, sometimes when they are instructed by their parents to do something, or rather ordered, they refuse. They deny, for example, if you say, tell them that do this chore, come and eat now, they straight up refuse. And some perceive this to be a sign of disrespect, of them, their children being rebellious and already rebelling against the authorities. Is this always true? Like, should we respond by reprimanding the teenagers, or rather should we take a step back and perhaps figure out the reason behind this outlash?
If the parents react and reprimand or punish or scold or shout, it's like adding fuel to the fire.
Right.
The person's going to come back strongly, more strongly, with the wrong choice of words, stronger words, and all that.
And then everybody would regret what happened.
Exactly. Right. And then after 5 minutes, there's intense silence and there's so much tension that you can cut it with a knife.
Yes.
That kind of a scenario.
Right.
I would suggest that one is that not just look at that, why is he behaving in a particular way and why is he responding this way? That's one way to look at it. But right there, right then and there, what can they do is that use more of a logical approach, a rational approach. And then instead of, you know, reprimanding. So let's say it's time for dinner. Come join.
Come eat.
Come eat or come join. And then this person is like, I'm not hungry now. Right. Don't come back immediately. Just give him a couple of minutes. And like, rather than saying that, no, it's time for dinner, you have to come here.
Don't escalate.
Escalate it. So what you can do, the father can go to the son, sit next to him, like, is everything okay? Are you all right?
Right.
Do you need any advice? Is there a problem? Is someone bullying you? Right. Whatever topic, not necessarily bring up some of the sensitive topics
just
like bullying
example.
Up. I'm just giving an example.
Like, what's the reason you do not want to eat? Right.
More than that, just don't ask the reason for not eating. Ask overall in general stuff. That is everything okay? Are you okay? Are you all right?
Because that's not normal behavior.
Exactly. Do you want to talk? Something like that.
Right.
And there's a high probability that he might come back and say, no, I don't want to talk. Like, okay, fine. That's okay. Give him some time to cool down. You know?
Right.
And then, you know, now with a more pleasing and a more subtle voice, more easy choice of words.
A diplomatic
approach. More diplomatic or a soft tone with a soft set of words. Invite him again to the dinner. And then this time around, there's a high probability, because he's able to vent out and cool down.
And also perhaps feel regret at rejecting you.
And realize that I have overreacted, and my father dealt it really nicely, very pleasantly. Right. And then he might, you know, subtly ease into the situation and he might come in.
Right.
So using a more logical and a more soft approach is more... result-oriented than just, you know, shouting and reprimanding and commanding.
Basic problem-solving. Right. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, dear Chef.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, another question that I have for you is that previously we have discussed the different traits and characteristics that we see in teenagers. Are there any other types of traits or signs that we as parents we need to notice so that we may better manage and understand our teenagers?
Like we had pointed out in our earlier sessions that, you know, certain traits that are prevalent in older teenagers, like being attracted towards opposite sex, trying to establish their own identity, and you know, being emotional and those hormonal changes that they're going through. Please remember, the fundamental and the necessity for the parents to identify these traits is the more they identify, the more they understand, and the more they're clear about the personality, these characteristics and traits of their teenagers, the easier it becomes for them to handle their children, their, you know, be it a girl or a boy.
Right.
The less understanding they have about these traits and characteristics of the teenagers, the more challenging and difficult they find to handle and deal with their children, right? So we discussed a couple of them. There's another one, and it's a very, very important one. All the parents have attention towards this. They understand, but they really don't know how to deal and handle with this. And one of them is the one that we're talking about is the teenagers being self-focused and self-focused. They focus upon themselves. They pay more attention to themselves than people around them. They're constantly spending more time upon themselves.
Self-conscious, you mean?
More than self-conscious. One is being self-conscious, as in the personality type I am, the existence that I have. But here, they are focusing their special attention on themselves, right? So they would spend more time in front of the mirror, trying to look at themselves, trying to comb their hair, trying different hairstyles, trying different beards. So they would, you know, try and keep a goatee, or they'll try to keep a French beard, or, you know, grow their hair. They'll try, you know, different makeup styles. If it's girls, then they'll try different lipstick colors to see which nail polish suits the best. So now they're more focused on themselves, that what color suits me the best. Does a t-shirt go? Does a shirt go good on me? A low jeans, a high jeans, a tight jeans. So they're more self-focused and self-attentive. So they're paying attention to themselves on multiple levels. One is their physical self, one is their intellectual self, and one is their emotional self. But most prominent and the most apparent and noticeable is their physical self. So this is where you will see the teenagers trying different clothings, different styles of clothings, and
they're trying to find their correct appearance, the appearance, most beautiful form of themselves.
And they see around them that the different trends that are going around, and then they're like, which trend do I fit into, and which one suits me the best? So they want to try and experiment, and they're like fully focused upon themselves. They don't care what the mom thinks about it, what the dad thinks about it. They're like, okay, I'm gonna wear these jeans, which is which has, you know, seven slits in it from knee length, the ripped jeans and all that. So this is where we need to understand that one of their necessary need is that they want to look at themselves. They are self-focused. They're not self-centric. It's not that they're ignoring everyone else. It's only that they're trying to establish what goes well with me. right?
Right. Let's continue this discussion. Sorry for interrupting you after a quick break.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upping. Sheikh, just before we went on a break, you were talking about how teenagers in this phase, they are very, not self-centered, but they are very, other than self-conscious, they look at themselves a lot. They try to change their appearance, try to find the correct fit and form. So do they do this for themselves exclusively, or is it also because of the society or the circle or the school they go to? Or is it just for themselves?
Correct. There is an influence from the society and the kind of culture they're living in and the influence of their friends and the community right. They are in.
Social pressure, for example.
Social pressure, it's there. But if you ask me, they do it for their own self, mostly. So you would see that some of their friends, even some of the friends, tell them that, look, this hairstyle is looking really bad on you, but this guy still continues with that hairstyle because he feels that it looks good upon him. Because he's tried 7 different hairstyles at home, standing in front of the mirror, and they're like, okay, this looks good on me. This t-shirt looks good on me. Even though the father says, like, this is the worst t-shirt.
You look like a hobo.
Yeah, you look like a guy who's been working in coal mine, right?
Right, yeah.
But this guy's like, no, this t-shirt suits
it's
me
stylish.
The best. That's right. My style, right?
Yeah.
So it's more to do with themselves, looking at themselves and feeling convinced that this looks good on me, this color looks good on me.
And is that because they want to find their identity, you think, or what is your professional take on this?
It is because they want to find their identity. When we talk about teenagers, right, they communicate through everything. The way they walk, the way they talk, the way they dress, the way they comb their hair, even the backpacks they select and the choice of words. Everything is a message to people around them that, look, I have this personality type.
Right? And I am different from you.
I'm different from you. I'm not like you. I'm unique. I'm way different than you, and I am special, and I'm unique. And I'm not one of the millions, but I'm one among the millions. I'm the rare one. So that's what they want to establish. And that's why you will see a lot of teenagers trying to do weirdest things to gain that special attention to portray the fact that I am the unique one. I was in Australia 10, 12 years ago, and I noticed young children, 14, 15, and they're goths. You know, you saw the way the goths dress, right? Black nail polishes, eyes and all that, right?
Yeah, punks all that
and
stuff.
Goths.
Right, yeah.
So I saw this girl. She's about 14 years, and she's got more piercings than her, the teeth. She had piercings in the nose, in the ear, in her lips. And I'm like, why is she doing that? That is because of the identity crisis. She's not able to establish her personality. And she's like, one piercing is not going to get me enough attention. Therefore, I need 12 piercings, right?
Yeah.
And this is what happens at the teenage, to get that necessary attention, because they want to show that I am unique.
So this attention that they want, dear Sheikh, what can we do as parents who, satisfy this attention, to control this attention-seeking behavior?
This attention-seeking behavior exists in teenagers before they enter into teenage and till the end of teenage. And even after that, if this desire and this need is not satiated, not addressed, this goes on even when they're married after 25, after 28, 30 years. So there are methods, inshallah.
It calls for a long discussion. Yes,
so inshallah, in our next episode, we can look at this and... deal with it.
That would be great, inshallah. I thank you for contributing to this discussion, and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
A child-sized doll screams and rolls its eyes while lying on a table as engineer Hiroki Takimoto looks on calmly. But instead of being a child's toy, the doll is a humanoid robot mimicking critical medical symptoms designed to train dental workers. The robot was co-developed by Japanese robotic startups Team Sock and a local dental school. Pediaroid was designed to stimulate a child's responses when receiving dental treatment, including changes to its medical condition. Using a tablet programmed with different medical conditions, the user is able to send signals to air cylinders installed within the robot's joints to move its entire body, mouth, and tongue to display physical reactions and facial expressions.
Medical workers really need to experience medical emergencies. It's important that they experience a situation where something goes wrong, and that's what it can simulate. As for the future, we would like to further develop it in such a way that various other people who are involved with childcare, such as mothers, elementary school teachers, childcare workers, and nurses, can experience emergency simulations.
Director of Team Sock's engineering division, Yusuke Ishii, said the robot was developed due to the lack of clinical dental training to treat children. Currently, at a hefty price tag of about 25 million Japanese yen, Team Sock hopes to develop the hyper-realistic robot further such that people from other childcare industries, including pediatricians and elementary school teachers, would be able to use it for other emergency situation training. Iran has hosted an iftar dinner in support of Palestine amid a rise in Israel's violence against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran. Let's check it out.
Turn the pot over to let the tasty maqluba slip into the dish. Maqluba is a Palestinian upside-down rice, usually cooked with chicken or lamb. Now, these Iranian and Lebanese women have taken part in a group cooking of maqluba as a solidarity gesture with Palestinian women amid the escalation of the Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. They say maqluba is not just a delicious food, but a symbol of the downfall of Israel.
Maqluba is indigenous to the Levant area, such as Lebanon, Syria, and especially Palestine. The last stage of the food's recipe is to run over the pot that contains the food. Today, it has become a symbol of victory for Al-Quds and a defeat for Israel.
Turning over the pot symbolizes the downfall of Israel. Interestingly, Israel has imposed a ban on the entry of pots into Al-Aqsa Mosque since they have come to learn about what it means to turn over the maqluba pots.
Since the start of the month of Ramadan, Israeli forces have been assaulting Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, injuring scores of people. The escalation in tensions has drawn worldwide condemnation, with protesters calling on the UN to take action to end the regime's crackdown against Palestinians.
Palestine is for Palestinians. Israel has been repeating its barbaric behavior towards Palestinians since 7 decades ago, and today it has taken its violence to another level by doubling down on its use of force. I think they are angered by Palestinians' resistance, and that's why they have resorted to violence.
This humanitarian move is one of tens of solidarity gestures staged in Iran and worldwide in support of Palestinians. The event also comes ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan.
enjoy the maghluba and wish Palestinians good luck in their struggle against occupation. Chefs here say, aside from symbolizing the victory of Al-Quds against occupation, this event seeks to raise awareness of the Palestinian suffering and to call on other nations to jump on the wagon and voice their support for Palestine's resistance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A museum in France is hosting treasures of Peru, including the famed Machu Picchu, in a unique experience where technology meets archaeology. Visitors can immerse themselves in a vertical tour of Machu Picchu Citadel and see an exclusive exhibit of Peruvian archaeological objects. The collection is arranged chronologically, passing through the extraordinary diversity of some 13 cultures. The collection displays 200 artifacts spanning three millennia, dating as far back as 1500 BC. A large part of the exhibit is dedicated to Peru's Machica civilization with their vase portraits and red ceramics. The museum's curator says the goal was to show that pre-Columbus Peru was far deeper than just the Inca era. Iran's National Museum is displaying a collection of artifacts that was stolen decades ago, but has finally returned home after a long legal battle. The items, which include sacred figurines, pots and jars, date back to more than 3,000 years ago. They were stolen and sent to the West more than four decades ago. In 1991, the British Museum was seeking to buy the collection from a smuggler residing in Switzerland. The objects, however, were seized by Swiss police and revealed in court in 2008. Since then, Iran had been trying to get the stolen treasures back home.
Under pressure from the Iranian diplomatic apparatus and the official complaints of the National Museum in 2015, the legal process continued, and finally on December 20th, 2020, the collection returned to us.
The collection belongs to the northwestern city of Bukhan, which was the home of Manians around the 10th to 7th centuries BC. The Manians were one of the first nomadic tribes to build cities in that area. The director of Iran's National Museum says the effort to recover other stolen artifacts continues. The country is now holding talks with the US and Australia to return ancient objects smuggled over there.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
How long could you work at your job? In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do, and there you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and Breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Othman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity.
Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turn barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most. Magic returns to Belgium with a purple carpet of bluebells covering the undergrowth of Hallerbos woods near Brussels. Each spring, this beech forest turns into a bluebell spectacular, turning the area into a natural wonderland. Millions of these blooming flowers sprout up across the 550-hectare woods, filling the air with their sweet aroma. The short but enchanting blooming phase offers nature enthusiasts a one-of-a-kind experience.
It is an outstanding and magical place because whenever we come, there's an amazing atmosphere. The sunrise was truly beautiful this morning, and we know this offers the opportunity to take great photos and decorate our house. It is a great comfort during these tough times.
Visitors can stroll the winding paths and watch rabbits and deer wandering through the woods. The forest floor blooms for a period of 7 to 10 days. After this time, leaves begin to grow on the trees above them, blocking the sunlight from reaching the flowers. The phenomenon of bluebell forest is not uncommon in Europe, but the Hallerbos greenery is unique for the density and beauty of its blossoms. A huge pink moon has glowed over Chilean skies, mesmerizing stargazers and ordinary citizens alike. The full moon was completely visible over the capital, Santiago. The celestial phenomenon is called a pink moon as it appears in April and is named after an American plant, pink plot, that blooms in spring. The pink moon will shine during the weekend through early Monday and may be visible in most parts of the world. The phenomenon also marks the calendar for different religious festivities around the globe.
Sunny skies and spring temperatures made for the perfect setting for the 65th birthday